Welcome to the December 2021 edition of Poet Radio on WGXC. My name is Chris. My guest on the program this month is a poet and essayist, Patrick Pritchett. Patrick was born in Indiana, raised in California, and mainly resided in Colorado, Massachusetts, and Connecticut in recent years. Patrick's authored several books, most recently Refrain Series in 2020, Orphic Noise 2017. Patrick teaches at the University of Connecticut in Hartford, has taught at Amherst, Harvard, and also fairly recently spent a year teaching in China. His blog on Blogspot, Writing the Messianic, is about 10 plus years worth of commentary, reviews, etc. Very interesting, worth taking a look at for sure. Although we didn't cross pathways until recently, our trails have crossed poetically in years before that, particularly in the journal Hambone and connections with Naropa University. I've come to know Patrick personally this year as we happen to live on the same road in Connecticut. Yes. Because of that, we're able to record this session of Poet Radio in person, which I haven't been able to do for almost 2 years. Since January 2020, I'm glad we have a chance to meet up today. How's it going?
Thanks, Christopher. Thanks for that introduction. And
well, here we are. We just finished our academic semesters. Have a chance to hear some of your poems and chat a bit about what's on your mind and your interests. So where do you want to start?
Well, I think I'll just start by reading the opening poem of Gnostic Frequencies, which is titled Doctrines of the Lyric Body. And I guess I could say that the original title for this poem for years, this book was Doctrines of the Subtle Body. So Doctrines of the Lyric Body is a play on that. And Doctrines of the Subtle Body, as I explain in the somewhat lengthy afterword to the book, is a book that was written, circa 1912 or 1915 by the theosophist G.R.S. Meade, who was Madame Blavatsky's secretary. It's an exposition of these theories of a kind of astral or ethereal body, if you will, the soma pneumaticon. That's one word he gives for it. I don't think I actually believe in the subtle body, but it's certainly an attractive metaphor for poetry. So I just sort of seized on to that since this book explores a lot of themes related to Gnosticism. Meade was also connected, interestingly enough, with the modernist. He was friends with Yeats. He invited Pound to give a lecture in 1915, I think it was, at the Theosophical Society, which was called Psychology and Troubadours. And that's where Pound first advances his notion of the fantasticon, which is sort of similar to a subtle body, I guess. It's the idea that, souls can change bodies, sort of metempsychosis kind of thing. It's the foundation, the metaphysical foundation for Pond's idea of persona, which of course became the title of one of his early best-known books. So he wrote a lot of those persona poems. And so I'm trying to do that in a similar way. But I'm not, I'm not buying into the whole we can actually do this. I'm just more interested in trying to inhabit these different poetic voices. However, this poem is just a sort of prelude or opener. Doctrines of the Lyric Body. First of all, it is whisper rather than light, a torched sibilance in the ear, a refrain, not a shine, the earth heathen with the tombs of Sacré-Cœur, their dismal fonts, their baptismal flights. Absent music, language is catastrophe. Mere prose is grief before the torn rose, the grain of wood insane inside the book's crooked pages. Whatever is read there is abandoned to trance, to the flowering silence that folds the sign in gathering the sink and pith of matter. Resonant crystal directing signals over impossible distance, the cloud of song, the light tree nested in stanzas of shanti, of whiteness or candor. Let the sinking of form also be form, the mystery of insatiate skin, glowing with the tendon of flame and the story of its leaping over, the shape of two crows, cruciform, and the boat of their going over. Beautiful, we say a wing is destroyed in its motion, but moving always has seance through scroll, bright amid the flare of the letter, its folding. Garment me, love, with the mere scrap of shadow.
I'm glad you started off with that poem because it has in it a couple of points that I was able to connect first with like your project as a poet overall, it seems, and then also sort of setting, you sort of in it, to me, you're set a certain, the bar of poetry at a pretty high level. I mean, this line here that got my attention was about absent music, language is catastrophe. So, you know, to me, that's saying something about what you expect or demand of writing. And as I've come to know your work, you have this like desire for like, you know, an intensity with language or a dynamism with language. It's just not average. Like you have a high expectation. You put that on language. Is that right?
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely correct. It's a good reading. I mean, this kind of comes out of my reading of and my early love of the Romantics, but also poets like Hart Crane, for instance, you know, people who, or Dickinson, who write at this, you know, white hot intensity. My later poetry sort of slacked off from that, I think, because it's hard to sustain. But when I first started writing these poems in 2003, I think it was, when I was still living in Boulder, I was very much after that and trying to subduct some sort of, you know, mystical energy into language.
Right, right. But I like it because, I mean, I think that's obviously should be every poet's objective. But yeah, then it's not done in this sort of like didactic, you have to do this way, because I totally love the lines, let the sinking of form also be form. I thought that, I mean, to me, that says something like, all right, if you're not going to, you know, be, you know, a formalist, then you better make whatever you do something as good as that or something, you know,
yeah,
like you have to, you can't just be screwing around. You
know? Right.
I mean, and maybe there are too many poets out there who are doing that, and maybe even too many teachers who are promoting that kind of thing. I guess they sometimes call that word salad.
Yeah.
Maybe word salad would be its own form.
Well, sure. I mean, all forms have a certain legitimacy, I think, but I just don't cotton much to poems that are mere anecdotalism or, you know, today I looked out the window and saw a bird, you know, and was reminded of the transience of nature, you know. I mean, we've had thousands of poems like that, and the language has to be charged and transcendent, you know. And most poets seem to shy away from that. And in fact, the attention to the ordinary and the quotidian is sort of actively encouraged. And I get that, you know, but it seems, and a lot of fine poems have been written in that vein, obviously. The New York School went that way to get away from the mire of highfalutin intentions that was marked so much of high modernism. But I guess so I'm trying to return to that in a way,
right,
in my own peculiar way. It's not like I don't like those poems or don't value them or don't get a lot out of them. It's just not the way I write.
Well, then in the book, you proceed to go in this more like sort of Poundian direction. And that's interesting because you do bring in so many classical references or from mythology, et cetera. So that's an interesting place to go. You know, there's not much to say about your poetry and poetics, so maybe we should hear some more poems. Did you have more from that book that you wanted to read?
Sure.
Just so the listeners get a little bit of a sense of...
So the poem's in three sections, or the book is in three sections, and the first section deals with a kind of imaginary character named Ariel, who's envisioned as a scribe or scholar in the ancient library of Alexandria. And this is all just sort of, you know, stuff that I made up. There was no such person. In the back of my mind, I think I had in mind Hypatia, the Neoplatonic philosopher, who was a woman who gained considerable fame as a philosopher, but then I forget the details of her story. There's actually a movie made about her starring Rachel Weisz, which I have yet to see, even though it's been out for years. She fell afoul of the authorities, either for her Neoplatonic doctrines or because she was a woman, or both.
Yeah.
So I was sort of thinking of a figure like that. It was kind of revolutionary. So this is Ariel in the marketplace. She is identified in the surviving text primarily through the recurrence of certain tropes: wing, library, seed. So a ghost wearing the prowl of her own voice through the whirlwind of the corpus symbolicum. Devotion, she says, is a blank, possibly two words, and the light rescinds. She strolls across the morning of the great festival, the sea close beside her, has the grand corniche strewn with petals. All day long, she opens the single letter, the book that wrote itself out of air, out of dust, from the heavy silk of beach fires and washed-up wood, where the noise you hear is only the names and counter-names, a confusion of precision rhymed with the dead. The book, O Prince, is a dream of one white letter. So the image of the book, you know, repeats itself quite a bit. You know, the book is sort of in the Jabezian sense of, or even the Judaic sense, has a kind of all-encompassing symbolic text that's both holds all the secrets of the universe, but is also completely blank. It's kind of Mallarmean, actually, when you think about, you know, his famous remark that the whole entire world exists to end up in a book, which, you know, is pretty radical.
No, I know that your sort of commentary on the book weaves throughout this collection, right? And that was connecting with me on the, as I was saying, the first poem to me seemed like almost a call for craft. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the book being sort of the repository for the craft, something to be taken seriously, considered from these different perspectives and what have you. So, yeah. And here we are in like the point in our history where books are kind of questioned. Here we are with digital media, audiobooks.
Yeah.
What is the relation of the book to the audiobook or the ebook or Kindle, that kind of stuff? Mm-hmm. So I imagine, you know, the power you sort of entrust or see in the book can be conveyed by digital media. I don't want to get into that whole conversation.
Sure.
But there has to be, the book is symbolic of the repository. And I think that can be conveyed in, media.
I don't see why not. It doesn't have to be a solid, you know, tangible codex, you know. In a way, digital books are could be thought of as more spiritualized because they're intangible, right?
Uh-huh.
The letters exist. Well, they exist on some server somewhere, but they're sort of just floating out there.
Interesting.
You know.
Yeah. I think it's a good attitude to have about
it. Yeah. Yeah. People have argued about, you know, that forever, since the invention of writing, I guess.
Right.
But it's still the storage and transmission of knowledge or data, if you will.
Well, here we are on the radio. And another kind of transmission. And then there's archive on the radio station. So we still, we have to put our all into it.
Absolutely.
Right on.
Yeah. Good. We're on the same page on that, right. So to speak.
Very good. Nice pun.
Shall I read another poem?
Yeah, sure, great.
The spectral logic of the temporal folds in on itself, she writes, so that grammar becomes a parable about decay and how each book makes a shadow to trail after it. The unwritten can only speak of hope, which is a wound we carry and learn to believe in. But if I enter the broken world, tracing the visionary company of departed love and trailing what starves, that only by its logic can I think each ghost to its aura of dust, which is also a letter, nocturnal hosanna, inhuman vesper. To be concerned with grammar is to take up utopia. To take up utopia is to consider the mechanism by which it will one day burn us to the ground. That sounds kind of ominous.
Yeah. I mean, I guess utopia is the, you know, can sort of the thing to pick up on there. You mentioned your interest in romantic poets early on.
Right.
And then that always takes me to my own. I mean, I also had, when I was very young in college, undergrad, that's what I was reading. That's what inspired me. And then there's a whole question about utopia, dystopia. What is utopia ultimately? And here we are.
Right. Utopos literally means no place.
Yeah.
Which is what the pun that Thomas More fashioned when he wrote his book, which I've never read, I should add.
So it's kind of an impossibility in the end.
Yeah, exactly. It's an impossible place, but everybody envisions it. Like Oscar Wilde famously said, a map that does not have utopia on it is not worth having. You know, which is a wonderful saying, right? Because he's saying leave room for, you know, the imagination to people unknown spaces or as yet to be created spaces. But other people, like Michel Foucault, have come up with the idea of heterotopias, you know, which is where difference can thrive. And I've come to prefer the notion of the messianic, since utopia is often thought of as a prescription for a perfect political order. And of course that just is impossible, as we've seen throughout history.
Mm-hmm.
And even the utopian communities in the 19th century, you know, that popped up here and in Europe, let alone the gigantic failure of, you know, China and the Soviet Union with all the suffering they inflicted. So it's unsustainable, but the messianic is like sort of apart from political aspirations. It's something that can happen at any time, you know, where you can, as Benjamin thinks of it, the now time that can just sort of intervene in linear time. I mean, it's an idea with political potential, but it's not prescribing a political order. So, you know, it's kind of difficult to wrap your head around, actually.
All right, and we can go on talking about how this is all part of your book, Gnostic Frequencies, after maybe hearing a few more poems, because I think that there's
a
connection there for sure.
For sure. Of the angel who is abyss, go, sundering book, echo of a vast disturbance. Inside the smallest of your letters, spill, then spell, the secrets of how the resurrection gate builds the lyric body. The heaviness of sleep thrums inside a fountain of nerves, and only the book about the book may awake or sever us as run to the doom of its embrace. Form fades into paper, and the shining bird who sang it sings from the shade for the disappearance of the poet. Then the angel who is abyss, who says the book must contain all existence, prizes the beating heart from the cradle of its slurried chamber, announcing, I am the hour, make me pure. In the ceremony of evening, nothing is complete until the poem, too, is wholly dismembered.
Mm. Now we're into part two of your book. This is the section Master. The master of the book.
Right.
So you're going more directly towards some of the themes.
Right. And a lot of these poems are homages to to poets I see in a certain lineage, you know, Blake, Duncan, Garrett Lansing, H.D., so forth and so on. So this is kind of a, this poem is kind of a prelude to it, and it exhibits a certain violence, you know. The poet disappears, then an angel prizes the beating heart. Sounds kind of gross.
That was like Shelley, right? That's the myth of Shelley.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Like sending his Pyrrhic, you know, funeral.
Right.
The heart is still
I hadn't thought of that connection. That's great.
It's funny what comes up. I haven't thought of that.
Yeah.
You know, your poems are provocative in that way.
Yeah. There's all kinds of little resonances and illusions pinging off of one another. And the idea, I guess, that the poem becomes dismembered as sort of the precondition for its resurrection. That it's a sort of continual cycle of transformation or something like that.
Hmm.
You know, I didn't really think these poems out schematically when I wrote them. I just wrote them.
Yeah.
This is one I like. The Dream of Yeats. Speaking of Shelley. And the women who burned Shelley's body, did they burn the Book of Shadows and all its letters? Did they write in our names as music sliding out of sleep and strewn with broken figures? Were their heads circled with light? Being dead, did they rise as swans and so create the final reach to translunar paradise? Because I speak, death joins joy to the intercourse of light. The soul in the evening walks beside my love. The soul is a song that forms the body with a look. Now an apple cups its poise of dew, and all the grass is gone to shivers. Death, ruin earth, then go past ruin. But an apple for my true love who walks through evening, the green stain of its furnace. The soul is what they say cannot stop from singing. Grass, what goes through Avalon ravenous, it's cold green water running.
Yeah, I see other references to Shelley here now that I'm, you know, in your book too. You have a whole poem called Shelley Unbound.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that one.
I didn't mean for this to come up and be a thread in it, but sure. I mean, you know what it is? I think reading your work and seeing your blog also, you sent me a link to an essay that you had written about Gnosticism. And
right.
And beyond that, looking deeper into your blog, you have a list of poets, and you kind of qualify them as how they are Gnostic, which is funny.
It's supposed to be funny.
Yeah, right. And I know you went to Naropa, and the thing for me was that I was also a student there, and I'm a student of Ginsberg's there. Some of my earliest conversations with Ginsberg involved Gnosticism and Gnosticism in poetry. And I had just written my undergraduate thesis on Shelley, so it was like this. I had this interesting connection with Ginsberg, Shelley, and Gnosticism, and the Buddhism at Naropa as well, and sort of the types of things I was being introduced there, the contemplative education. So all of a sudden there is this kind of, I don't think it's the microchips that are bringing us together here with all this. I think it's something much deeper into
definitely,
you know, the poetic overlaps that I sense with you just because of a sort of placement
No, that makes perfect sense. And of course, Ginsberg's lifelong interest in Blake, Whitman, and also Shelley, you know, that kind of fiery strain of romanticism that runs through his work as well. You know, there's this sort of hunger, striving for transcendence, that the world is more than what we can see, that, you know, that's not just reduced to material things. But there's a spirit that infuses or inflames it. You know, those are all powerful ideas that can also stand apart from everyday Christianity, you know, which I think is what those poets were going for.
You have more poems from the master of the book, or?
Yeah.
Should we go to book three?
Yeah, I'm ready to move on.
Gnostic frequencies.
Yeah, I'll read the title poem. Gnostic Frequencies. Imagine this. Murmur has murmur only just this much of white's whiteness giving body color. Cold the blue eyes, now the white insists it grows older together. But never what it is, imagine this. Imagine this, murmur, color and no body, color and no bird fixes the light of its song to a branch. Color and not all white, has murmurs, has pulses, feeling the seance of matter as it leaks through the hands. Imagine this, murmur, the apocal and the apocryphal, the dunes shifting and the planet lying low tonight under stars, the cars drift westward and the cars are in heaven and driven by angels. Imagine this, murmur, for it is night, your speech is low, it is the door and the window, it says to go out is to spread a name, but be is not to spread a name, but be host to the power of what is in between. Murmur, imagine this, only shining, white, infinite, but not known. In its heat, a sentence murmurs, the secret of transparency is the opacity of its halo. Light over all, light falling through the grass of light that are silent and on fire.
In the copy of the book you gave me a few weeks ago, you finish up with a second imagine.
Yes.
Imagine this, as if, you know, I mean, that's what we're forced to do.
Right.
We can't do anything else. That's the charge of the poem.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And, yeah. So it's funny. It's I thought, I don't know if that was like a little subtle message for me.
No, or, it's actually written in this one too, Chris.
Oh,
it was supposed to be in the poem, and then somehow it got deleted. But then I decided not to read it. So
I can see how that would really be effective in a performance. Like if you're giving a reading and everybody's like transfixed, and you'd leave off of like a poetic pause and
imagine this. I actually take that phrase from Beckett. Or imagine dead, imagine. It's how one of his short pieces starts. I just like, that was like the prompt, so I just started playing with that.
That's cool. It's different than the John Lennon version.
It's considerably. That's more utopian.
Yeah, right.
Which is okay.
But, you know, we've heard that so many times that
we
need to be presented with an alternate thing to deeply imagine.
Yeah, it's
it's a different kind of idealism altogether.
Yeah,
actually.
Definitely. Yeah,
that's cool. And this is a great. I love this. This section of the book also has like homages to others as well.
I haven't looked at this book in so long, so I am.
Well, you know, you're maybe there's a poem in here for Robin Blazer, but Blazer is a poet that I could compare your work to as well,
and his
interest would expand into these the outside as
oh, definitely. He's a poet I've long admired, and I met him and heard him read when he came to Naropa in the late '90s or early 2000s. Such a lovely man.
Yeah, and full of classical, reference or touchstones as well.
Right.
Very good.
Yeah, but not in a heavy-handed way, you know.
No, but a very erudite, serious mode, a la Pound in a way.
Right, yeah.
You're in that solid new American poetry, pantheon, lineage, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Maybe post-new American kind of like. That was big.
I like that, post-New American, yeah. No, it was huge.
Post-New American, that is a funny phrase, post-New.
See
what I mean? Because it's not old, but it's like a refinement of or something.
Yeah, well, it makes instant sense. But you're right, it's sort of oxymoronic.
No, it's all good. I think there should be more of that, honestly.
Yeah.
Well, but also needs to be expanded in certain ways too. Like, I mean, if I think of someone like Nate Mackey, who's that's exploded and gone all,
yes,
so many different ways, and that's, it's so rich, right? So we see that it can be done,
He's definitely the standard bearer for that.
You think
carrying it forward? Yeah.
Interesting.
because he's heavily invested in the mythopoetic a la Duncan and
sound
projectivist and sound
sentiment language play
there's
a lot more too. He imbues it with other things. Anyway, let's go back to your work. I mean, now that we've established,
okay,
the milieu.
All right, that sounds good. I guess I'll just read a couple more from this, and then we could, or maybe just one more. We can switch over to refrain series if you like.
Sure.
In a summer season, a fire to fire renew, summer the fall of light and season of mortal dews. Over all the evening set of moon, August high in the trees, equatorial burn. Grass under green water and cycle of song and circle renew fire of summer to summer, or signal the fade of the long moon that burns, orbit of fire alive under green water too.
The summer season. Now, is summer like, is that like old English for summer?
Yeah, that's the opening line from Langland's Piers Plowman, which is a 14th century long poem.
Mm-hmm.
My girlfriend at the time was really into it, and we were reading it together. I forget how it begins. You know, a field in a summer season, field of fair folk gather, or something like that.
Right, right.
You know,
that's something else that reminds me of. Because I was a summer student at Naropa, I'm catching this and thinking of Naropa, and knowing that you went there, I wanted to speak with you about that a little bit. I know that your involvement there was probably more, you probably were there more than I was as a student. But how did the, I'm curious to know, since we brought in all these different reference points and made these connections, you taught at Naropa and went to school there, is that right?
I didn't actually attend class. I was never officially enrolled. I just was sort of a perpetual hanger on.
And you lived because you lived in Boulder.
I lived in Boulder. I had a job at an IT company, and I was going back to school at CU, the University of Colorado, to get my master's and then my PhD. But Naropa is where I spent a huge amount of time, and Waldman very graciously and generously welcomed me into the community. I mean, I had a slightly antagonistic relationship with them at first because I started writing freelance book reviews for the Daily Camera, and I gave a sort of mixed positive review to Disembodied Poetics.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'd moved there from L.A., and I, sort of was skeptical about the whole Naropa project. And then I gave a negative review to Allen's Cosmopolitan Greetings, which earned me a sharp rebuke.
Oh, boy.
It was sharp but friendly from Anselm Hollow, who was quick to defend his friend. And I wrote him back, and said, maybe, you've got a point, And I don't even know if I kept that correspondence. But after he read that, he invited me over to his house. And we became really good friends. And so he was sort of a private mentor just through spending time with him. And we had a little publishing group together with two other Naropa MFA students, Mark Ducharme and Laura Wright, and Anselm's wife, Jane Dalrymple Hollow. And we created this press called Potato Clock Editions and published, five or six chapbooks before, kind of ran out of steam. And so just activities like that, you know.
And then you taught there as well.
Yeah, Anne invited me to teach twice. The second time was actually Elizabeth Robinson was teaching a course, and her father suddenly fell ill and was dying, and she had to go back to California. So she asked me if I would take over her class. And those were difficult shoes to fill.
No doubt.
Because I don't have the saintly aura that Elizabeth does. So that's the second time around.
Right, right.
Yeah, but
What was the course you taught?
It was called On Beauty.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know, which is not the kind of thing you might find on the syllabus.
somewhere
at Naropa or many places, really.
Right, right. That's cool.
So I brought what I could to it, you know, and worked okay. There was a great poet in that group named J. Michael Martinez, and he went on to win the Walt Whitman Award for his first book. But he was just brilliant, and he went on to do his PhD at the University of Northern Colorado in Greeley. I don't know what he's doing now. I mean, I didn't stay in touch. But I could tell then he was, you know, going places. So, you know, you meet people like that, it makes it worthwhile.
Right. And when you were there, by any chance, were you connected with Ed Dorn at all?
Yeah, I took one class with Ed, but I never really got to know him very well. That was the spring of 99, and it wasn't a creative writing class, oddly enough. It was a survey of British Lit 1, you know. And I was like, Ed Dorn's teaching British Lit. That should be interesting, you know. Yeah. And it was. It was great. He totally knew his stuff, you know. You know, we read Beowulf, but we also read Milton and Sam Johnson, you know. And, he was terrific. But that was the spring, unfortunately, where he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Yeah. So he missed 3 weeks in the middle of the semester. And, you know, it didn't go well after that.
Yeah. Just curious. And, I mean, your interest, you have interest in different kinds of literature. That would have been a special occasion to be with Dorn and,
yeah,
and English Lit.
Yeah, just hearing what his reflections were on, you know, this whole tradition of British literature were fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, he knew his stuff deeply, and he thought about it both as in a scholarly way, but also as a poet. So it's very rich.
Excellent. So let's see. I mean, there's a few things I'm curious to know about. You know, I know you have interest in film. I know that, you know, you've published a critical work. You're working or have a book coming out. A scholarly book, too.
I'm trying to finalize it, but it's been laying around for years. You know, it's going to be a monograph, but I've abandoned the idea. Now it's just going to be a collection of thematically linked essays, some of which have been published and some of which are new.
All right.
So,
but poetry is your main,
yeah,
your main emphasis as a, yeah, writer. So why don't we go to the most recent book?
Then? Yeah, okay, that sounds good. So I'll start out with the first poem.
Refrain series.
Right, and these don't have titles, they're just numbered 1 through 64. And suddenly it seemed to me we were more truly of the sky. A part of it has a wing as part of its soar, bladed in flight and alight with blue thrusting muscle, exerting form against the pulse of gravity, and across wide miles of space that enfold us, everything is horizon and receding, the day and what's ever in it. The hour as it leaves itself behind, warm odors of grass and late August sun, a wren pecking at the porch rail, and every song on the internet set free, returning to its maker for a festival of legacy. Van Zant and Wayne Shorter and four last songs, which slay me so dainly in short order, the ring of fire closes over, and whoever is drunk now will stay drunk in heaven or New Haven, all evening, copying the pages of Dew into their notebooks, making a chain of one change into the next, and humming intricate descriptions of the way trees move in the wind. Flaked filaments falling, things which do not last.
You know, when you read, when I read of your interest in cinema, and saw the essay, or sort of, it was kind of an essay about, you know, of films that you liked.
Oh, right, yeah.
On your blog. This, when seeing this poem, I instantly connected that interest with this poem. It seems to me to be like something I can imagine in an interesting movie. And this,
that's cool.
And yeah.
I like that.
Well, I was, you know, I don't know if I, you know, I wasn't necessarily looking for that in it, but it came. And this book is interesting to me because, and I would like for you to read a few more pieces before I say too much, but you know, there's some stylistic shifts that happen to it. There's a real arc too. I mean, the poems, honestly, when I was reading the book, I did not read it from front to back. I sort of started in the back and then worked my way through, and I was very surprised in a way. I felt the early poems were different than the later ones. So why don't you?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I wrote this. The poems are appear in the order that I wrote them. There are a few that didn't make the final cut, and you know, I wrote from August to January and then put them aside and then resumed at a later date because I just didn't know where it was going. Number five. In the small rain, the homes of the drowned and their lost dogs go white in the wake of the eye. No one sees this. Everyone sees this. The pain of the world travels over acres, cities, seas, and frequencies. Beneath the bonds of lyric, everything wants to burn. The solar ocean under high noon's arch. The children cavorting on the naked street. The maple that sheds its coughed grace and the ghost who sits at the right hand of evening humming, this wheel's on fire. We row in a dark river whistling past the images of emptiness to assuage our loneliness, as Creeley says. The dreams that come before first light invade us with the hope for a resurrection of perfect sex and the one book written in a language of fading fire that could rescue the earth with a handful of letters signing the air into fantastic signals. The heat and dust of another defeat drifts to larboard. All the poem has to give to this world is its own brokenness.
This kind of connection with the earlier book in that line.
Yeah, definitely. There's a kind of Gnostic vibe there with the idea of the broken world. Resurrection. Yeah, in some ways, these poems are constantly interrogating either a disaster that's already happened or one that's about to happen. But it's kind of unspecified as to what the nature of the disaster is. I'll read another one. Seven. Like the pristine void of zero, my cinders illuminate each scar, writing new histories to scan the bent light of dead stars for glimpses of the lost friend. The hour of the Lord grows smaller daily. By night, it hangs its sickle lantern in the cowl of trees and moans softly, wind across a dune. A lantern is always a message from beyond the grave. It flashes obscure signals. Go south, turn left, be late. Everyone on this side has been driven insane. As for comfort, we have received your petition to kneel. Pending approval, the chair promises to incinerate every page but the blank ones. Only by dreaming can the burnt book keep alive the letter in its whiteness and its peril. True song dismembered. Canticle of mute stone. Unnumbered tears, said the chronicler. True refuge is useless. So, yeah, I'm seeing resonances here too, Gnostic frequencies, the obsession with dismemberment,
right.
Dismembering the poem.
Well, this, you know, now that I was taking a quick look at my notes, you, the title of your scholarly book is listed as Make It Broken.
Is that right? That's correct.
So that's a real poetics, you know, that you're developing.
It's a play on Make It New, obviously. Of course. But, you know, since Make It New is no longer an option after
right.
World War II, poets have to take more drastic measures, you know.
So
that's why I write about people like Michael Palmer and, you know, John Taggart and Gustav Soben. And poets are sort of working in that modernist tradition, but they're changing it up.
Right, sure. Now, I notice in this book that that it's written 2018-2019, East Hampton, Changsha, China, Hastings on Hudson, Simsbury, and I mentioned earlier that you had taught in China, and I feel like I should ask about the China experience and how it influenced the poetry, if at all.
Well, I wrote a number of poems that appear at the end of this book or near the end of it while I was in China, you know, and they reflected some of my daily experience. You know, some of the sights and sounds that I recorded there and make their way into the book. but I didn't want them to be like travelogue-y poems or anything like that. China was a mind-bending experience. I'm still having trouble articulating it to myself, even after 2.5 years back. On the one hand, it was exhilarating and, you know, eye-opening. On the other hand, it was, you know, I grew to become increasingly alienated and dispirited, and I had some health issues while I was over there. That didn't help. And I just grew very homesick, you know, and realized that 1 year was all I was going to be able to do, you know, that I wanted to come back to the States. And fortunately, I was able to get these teaching gigs here in Connecticut.
Right. Well, that's good. But was it, I mean, what about the language? I mean, not only language barrier, but just, I mean, exposure to language.
Well, that was incredible. I mean, Mandarin remained completely opaque to me. I mean, I knew how to say hello and thank you, you know. It turns out you can get by with just those two words and a credit card. It's all you really need because, you know, a credit card is really the universal language in most transactions. All my students spoke English. Some of them were much more accomplished English speakers than others. And the classes were taught in English. The majority of my colleagues, at least the ones I interacted with, their English was quite good. So that didn't present any significant barrier. Because I didn't speak Mandarin, I wasn't asked to do any committee work, which was, you know, a relief. You know, but I also felt kind of like I didn't really know what was going on most of the time, you know.
That's like a culture shock type thing.
Yeah, I felt sort of in this little isolation bubble where, you know, I could perceive part of what was going on around me just walking down the street in obvious ways, but I couldn't overhear what people were saying. I couldn't have a meaningful exchange with a clerk.
Sure, sure.
Whatever, you know. So it left me feeling kind of at sixes and sevens, you know, just dispossessed.
Right. So, but you were writing the poems in this book at that time. Did maybe that circumstance pushed you more towards the, you know, writing poetry in English or something? Or you would have written, you know, I'm looking for something that's not there, which is like, oh, I went to China and this happened. So you were mostly already set on your, like,
The book was already had its own trajectory.
Yeah,
but
right.
The Chinese poems are, at least a few of them seem to me more noticeably melancholy, you know, where I'm trying to come to grips with this feeling of exile.
Right. I think that comes through, you know, in those poems at the end that I was.
Maybe
we should go through a few more poems while we have time.
Sure. I'll read one of those poems. And what are words? This is number 49. And what are words for? She asked. I mean, if not to name the day or the color of the skies, a flake of tinder growing in the flanks of Weilu Mountain, alive and green across from Starbucks here on Lushan Road. Where else but this place for a name, a merry-go-round, a blink, and a parking lot, all the names for whirling, swirling about it, at the very limit of poetic entanglements owed to strangeness. The name names itself in the realm of language, says the girl in the black dress. The black dress, the black dress. That is all ye need know, man. A name marks the future of the poem the way the five flags in front of Changsha Hospital fail when the wind drops. Our songs will all end in silence, he said. But what of it? Go on singing. Be gone in song. The long and tropic slough in the middle of the night. The form migrant with a desire for more. The origin of starlight engraved on bones. Whiskey splashed over white stones. So there really was a girl in a black dress that walked into the Starbucks who caught my eye. She's one of those perfect petite little beauties. I mean, there wasn't anything particularly astonishing about her, but somehow she made it into this poem. I have no idea who she was. And our songs will end in silence is from this incredible monologue that Orson Welles gives in F for Fake. where he's standing outside Chartres Cathedral and meditating on, you know, the passage of time and the fleetingness of art, and, you know, rolling it out in this, you know, majestic baritone, you know. It's a really beautiful moment. You can YouTube it, as I did. So, yeah.
You said Orson Welles, right?
Yeah, Orson Welles, yeah.
Yeah. I was hoping to get you to talk a little bit about your interest in cinema and how that connected with the poetic practice. I don't know if there's other poems in here that represent that or...
No, not really. I guess, I fell in love with movies, I guess early on, but just watching monster movies on Saturday mornings or whatever, but I didn't become a serious cinephile until college, you know, when I was in San Francisco State in the mid-70s, and there were still all these art houses all over town, and the campus itself had this Cinematheque and the Student Union, and you could go down there and for a couple of bucks and watch, you know, sit through a Fellini, a Bergman, and a Godard film, you know. So my friends and I just did that. And it was a real education, just a real eye-opener. I just saw as many films as I could. And I kept doing that for quite some time. And then at one point, I wanted to become a film reviewer. And in the early 90s, I started to do some freelance film reviewing for one of these fly-by-night arts and entertainment weeklies in L.A. That lasted for about a year and a half. But at the same time, I also managed to get into the film industry in Hollywood as a script reader. There was a big demand for script readers, for story analysts, as they're also called. So I ended up working for, you know, obscure agents and production companies that, you know, nobody had ever heard of. But then I ended up getting a job for Jim Cameron's Lightstorm Entertainment when he was making Terminator 2, and that was pretty cool.
Sure, sure.
And I got to know him a little bit. But then that led to a job as Catherine Bigelow's executive assistant for this movie she wanted to make about Joan of Arc. And that position lasted about 3 years. And in addition to reading a lot of scripts for her for other projects and sort of managing the development traffic, you know, interacting with agents and other producers and actors from time to time. It just involved mainly a ton of research on Joan of Arc.
Mm.
So at one point I felt like I knew as much about her as anybody on the planet, you know.
Wow.
I read all these biographies and I compiled notes and synopses and all of them too for her to read and for the screenwriter to read, Jay Cox. He's worked closely with Scorsese and is one of Marty's closest friends. And we've stayed in touch over the years.
Did the movie get made, the Joan of Arc movie?
No, sadly it did not.
Oh, my God.
I often think if it had, I'd probably still be in L.A., but maybe, maybe not. But what happened was Catherine set up a deal with Luc Besson, the French film director, to, you know, maybe cut a deal with French unions so they wouldn't charge us so much, or I forget what the particulars were. So we were thinking about shooting it in France. And he came over and they had meetings and, you know, he brought this storyboard artist over who started sketching panels and so forth. And then they had a falling out or something. Anyway, he stole the script and made it into his film, The Messenger. See, the main dispute was that he wanted his girlfriend at the time, Mila Jovovich, to play Sinead, and, or to play Joan, and Catherine wanted Sinead O'Connor to play Joan. He didn't make the exact film. It was called Company of Angels, but he stole significant story elements. And Catherine sued him, and it was settled out of court in her favor for an undisclosed sum. I don't know what, so.
But it did. It sounds like a really interesting experience in any case.
And, it was. And it was intense.
Now, you were at that point working as a poet also? And
well, I was trying to write poetry. I hadn't had any luck getting published at that point. This is in the early, mid-90s.
I see. But learning more about Joan of Arc or being exposed to all the cinema, is there any...
That became the basis for my first book, Chris. Burn, Doxology for Joan of Arc.
All right. I haven't seen that
so
one.
So that, yeah, I don't really have any copies left. It's out of print, but a bunch of it's been reprinted in Song X. So, yeah, I became obsessed with her and started writing these, you know, weird mystical poems about her that, you know, some of it was quasi based in her life and some of it was just, you know, stuff that came out of my reading of medieval women mystics, you know, they were really weird. So it was a lot of fun.
All right. Well, I have a couple minutes left here. Why don't we finish off the reading? We've got some more from the refrain series.
Sure. Let me see what I got here. I'll read this one. 62. And I am coming into song, its shining tablets made real by the sun. I am coming into song again, into its ancient kingdom of signs, the baptismal rhymes pulsing with stellar musics. The stars stream down, the stars stream cantos from the end of time, and all our ruin is encompassed there, held safe for the book we will write when we are dead. And all the things that book will sing, all the things that will not come back will still be here, each inside themselves. The long fade to crystal, the horizon made of slate, the earth a kind of sound, untranslatable.
Excellent.
I think that's probably a good note to end on.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. Yeah. You got to always trust a good ending.
Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic to get a firsthand experience with your poems. I haven't been no poetry reading since I met you, so we haven't been able to share that experience.
Yeah.
But it's nice to have you here at the house and. You know, I'm glad we have this proximity that has allowed us to do this. And
it's great.
I want to remind listeners that they've been listening to Patrick Pritchett on Poet Radio, WGXC, December 2021, where we have 50 and 60 degree days outside, and third week of December. It's a little odd, but nice to be here and great to have you on the show, Patrick.
It's been a huge pleasure. Thanks so much.
All right. So long.